Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Bushwick, Brooklyn at Roberta's Pizzeria on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 1 o'clock. Stas, how you doing?
Good.
I forgot to say that I was joined by you because I just said hello instead. Mm-hmm. You like that better?
Don't care.
Don't care?
No. We didn't get any new submissions for songs, Jack.
Yeah, I know.
Jack and Joe in the engineering booth, both, by the way, accomplished musicians.
Whoa. Oh, well, there it is. The call's been open. So, I mean, let's put it at the top of the show here. Maybe people pay attention more. We need a new theme song.
Listen, we like what we got.
We want to keep all the theme songs, but we want some more.
Yeah, I mean, so what were you thinking? I was thinking maybe like, so we have like cocktail jazz, like that, you know, the vicious vodka kind of redo, right? The fish is vodka. That's, you know, from the cocktail jazz kind of, you know, theory of operation, like Amos Milburn, that kind of stuff. And then, you know, we have a kind of a hardcore-y version, right? Right?
Yep.
So what do we don't have country.
We don't have a twangy country theme. We could use that. We could use maybe like a hip-hop beat theme.
Oh, hell yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, hell yes. Oh, yeah. But it had to be good hip-hop.
I know.
Either good hip-hop or like dumb in a really good way.
Right.
Like Lonely Island, good dumb, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or like actually good.
Or actually good.
Which is so hard, man. It's so hard to get hip-hop that's like, most hip-hop's in between, you know what I mean? It's tough.
What about like a club theme song?
You mean like what era? Like house? Like
yeah, goals? Like 80s house.
Yeah?
Yeah, let's
or like,
do that.
Or like 90s, like 90s ass and stuff, like James Brown is Dead. Like, who's that? That was L.A. Style. Remember L.A. Style?
I don't.
James Brown is Dead. We could do something like that. But the problem with them is that they came out with that song when James Brown was still alive.
What we really need is like a Hall & Oates type theme.
Justino, that would be amazing. Stas, at any given moment, Stas and I might just break into a Hall & Oates song at any given second. It might happen. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Maybe instead of playing break songs, you guys can just sing Hall & Oates songs on the break.
All right.
That's not allowed, right? With your...
Well, I don't know. It's also a little known fact that I kind of... I have singing Tourette's in that I kind of involuntarily insert curse words into the middle of songs as I sing them.
Mostly the C word.
No, I never use that.
Wow, wow.
In songs?
Yes.
I use the F-bomb in songs.
No.
Your mustache is incorrect.
You almost just cursed.
I know.
It was close.
Anyway, it's a bad habit. I'm trying to break it. But you know, that's what it is. But if someone's going to do country, like I mean, personally, Stas doesn't like country. You know why, Jack and Joe? You know why?
Why?
Because
thank you for that,
because she doesn't like stories. No, it's just sort of God. Stas, am I lying about that?
It's only since I started working with you
that
he'll play a country song, the same country song over and over, and he'll be like, "Can you believe that he left his wife for his dog?" And I mean, why would he do that? I mean, same breakdown. He analyzes these songs, same songs.
Oh, wow. But first of all, like,
is that like, not true?
I think some of these songs merit attention. They merit deep
song
reading.
You play. Merit's attention.
What? That's not true.
That's so true.
That's not true.
I hope someone's writing a story theme song for us right now.
I hope so too. Look, and you know what? You know, Stas didn't grow up watching TV, so like, you know,
we're. Did.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
How do you not like a story song if you grew up watching Gilligan's
it's
Island?
It's not about the story.
Gilligan's
it's about
Island.
Every time you play the country.
Look
songs.
Here. Look. Okay.
You analyze it.
So this is not country. Yes, because it's
but
like
the same analyzation every.
Analyze? Not even a word. Not even a word.
Analysis every single time.
Not even a word. How can I trust anything you say if you bust out non-words on me? You know?
Yeah,
but like certain injustices, Jack and Joe, like they hit me, so I have to mention them every time. So not country, but TV theme songs. You familiar with the Gilligan's Island theme song?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. You familiar with the first season of Gilligan's Island?
Probably. I used to watch a lot of reruns as a child of Gilligan's Island.
Right. Gilligan was like one of my best friends growing up. I watched that stuff constantly.
Yeah,
right?
I bought a Gilligan hat because I liked him so much.
Nice, nice. But anyway, so the first season was in black and white, right? And the song, which we all know, you know, at the end, the millionaire and his wife, the movie star, the professor and Marianne, you know, here on Gilligan's Isle, right? Right? We all know this? The original season, it was Gilligan, the skipper two, the millionaire and his wife, the movie star, and the rest.
The rest?
There's only two of them.
Two people.
Yeah, like in the time it takes you to say, the professor and Marianne, you could have just said, you know, and the rest. It's like the same thing.
But they changed it.
They changed it, but I mean, I don't know. It just seems like crappy. Everyone knows Marianne's a hot one. So why didn't she get on it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyways, I like story songs. I like to think about the stories in songs and why people made particular choices. You know, I like Merle Haggard. I mean, how did we get on this? It's all because of the theme song. All right, okay. So, call in your questions too. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. P.S. I'm not going to go into the full rant because. Because I, you know what, my veins will burst. I was up last night quite late writing. So Mike Efstrati, what Mike? You got a name? I can't pronounce names, Mike. Mike Efstratiadis. That's kind of a nice name, Efstratiadis. I hope I got that right. Says, hey Dave, I was wondering about MSG. Is it safe? What's with all the gloomy posts about it, Mike? Mike, how you do this to me? How do you
also,
make me
go back and listen to old shows?
No, Stas, that's an absurd. That's absurd.
The Heritage website and look for MSG specific shows.
Oh, God.
And then
that's not
he can hear you rant.
It's not okay. I'm not going to go into the full rant, Mike. Let me just tell you this. I'll give you a couple brief bullet points to use against people who talk about MSG. Most arguments against MSG either rely on a number of really turd basket studies about the actual purported effects on people. And then there's a lot of hoo-ha, hokum, bad science about excitatory neurotoxins. Because it turns out if you inject MSG into your brain, it's not a good idea. Don't inject anything into your brain, by the way. But there's a bunch of research that neonatal primates can get brain damage if you give them large amounts of MSG, without anything else. And it's because, it can cross the blood-brain barrier in primates but not in humans. In fact, your body produces MSG. Your body produces MSG not MSG, but it's because it's not monosodium, but it produces glutamic acid in your head. It's used as a neurotransmitter. It's then converted to glutamine and transported back across your blood-brain barrier to be excreted. So you're a net producer of it. There's no credible, decent evidence that it's bad for you. You don't consume enough of it for it to cause your blood levels to spike in any way unless you were to eat it pure and a large amount of it. And the only decent studies done are double-blind control studies where the actual MSG was administered in gel caps that couldn't possibly be detected by taste, and all of those show that there's no problem. And yet, despite all this, Nastasha continues to believe that she has some sort of reaction to it. True or false, does?
Nope. I just don't eat it anymore.
What kind of a horse crap is that? Trying to get out of saying that I just don't eat it.
Oh, I eat it in your snacks.
We don't use MSG in the snacks for consumption. We use it in our tests.
Oh.
We only use it in tests. Jesus. No brains. No brains. Stas, no brains. No, we use it, like, I use MSG. Piper, when he was with us, brought a lot of MSG. We did it to test snacks. Because what you do is when you're testing snacks out, you want to test how much kind of umami punch you need to add to the snacks in order to get kind of the flavor level where you want. And then the hard part is that to sell snacks to people, because people are irrational about this, you have to have them be MSG free. So then you have to go back and you have to punch that umami the same amount without using MSG. So typically, if you don't want it to taste like kombu or dashi, you add things like yeast extracts or other broken down protein products. Anyways, So there you have it, Mike, my non-rant version of MSG. But I'm sure that Jack can find when I went off on it before.
Oh, yeah, that was like the unplugged.
What, you mean because I was so loud you had to, like...
Yeah, last time you were really getting in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, so you can't do the same thing. This is what I want to go off on. Someone has to explain this to me. Are you guys shoppers at Subway, the store that sells submarine sandwiches with that bread with that
Oh, that's really bad.
Yeah, but do you go? My kids.
I haven't been in years.
I told you my kids love it, right? Because they get to customize their sandwich. I told you that. Oof. Did I tell you their new craziness? The new thing?
Oh, sriracha?
Oh, they have sriracha? No, yeah, I didn't know that. I mean, everyone's got sriracha. You know, there's a sriracha documentary, but I haven't seen it yet because you have to buy it. So I have to buy it and look. It's like a half-inch documentary on sriracha, and they interview the guy, and he's like, everybody loves my product. I can't help it. If people stop loving my product, maybe I'll stop making it. But everybody loves it. But he doesn't have that accent.
Great story.
Yeah, it is. It's a good story, right? And one of the PAs gets his eye sprayed with sriracha in the outtakes, which is hilarious. But anyway, no, not a sriracha. So here's what happens. I guarantee you, because I know how ideation stuff happens in these corporations, because, you know, we've done it a couple of times for people. So they're like, listen, guys, this is the Subway, the boardroom or whatever. They're sitting around the ideation room. They're like, hey, guys, listen. We want to sell pizza, but really we're a sandwich company, right? So we don't really have the wherewithal to sell pizza to people, right? Because we're a sandwich shop, yeah? So we have to, like, show – we have to demonstrate – something's wrong with a regular pizza or some point of difference so that people will buy our Subway-style pizzas instead of a real pizza they could get across the street, right? Right? Okay, so, guys, come on. What's wrong with pizzas? Wait, what do you got? Hey, Larry, what do you got? I don't know, man. Too greasy? Yeah, that's a good one. Too greasy. Hey, Harv, what do you got? Pizzas are too three-dimensional, boss. They're too three-dimensional. That's it. We're going to make a flat pizza. So swear to God, Subway has a new product called Flat Pizza because they perceived that the problem with pizzas is that they're too three-dimensional and need to be flattened out. What kind of dope were those dudes smoking when they came up with that idea? Who thinks that a problem with pizza is that it's too freaking flat? And by the way, the image that they have on their freaking advertisements is like a deep dish freaking thing. It's the least flat pizza. You know, they have no mechanism to actually make a flat pizza. They can't make, like, a cracker crust. They can't do... What is this?
It's like, fire-baked style.
What does that even mean? What does that mean? It has no meaning for me. Flat pizza. And it doesn't trip off the tongue. It's the worst word for a product. And people, there are millions of dollars involved in this decision. Like... Many dozens, hundreds of people had look, what kind of ogre runs that company such that no one underneath was like, boss, this idea sucks the royal root. This makes no freaking sense, boss. No one checked them on that.
It's Elio's, though, basically.
I don't even know what's an Elio.
Oh, you don't know what that is? The frozen flat pizzas?
But what do you mean flat? Oh. Pizzas are by their nature flat. There's like, it was like, I'm not like, you know what? I'm so sick of these kind of like three-dimensional globe-shaped puzzle pizzas that I've been getting recently at the local pizzeria. Makes no sense.
The thing about flat pizza is that it's the same amount of syllables as flat pizza. It doesn't save you any time. The name. It's bad.
Yeah, but you know what? They're like, hey, boss, we can't trademark flat pizza because it's just the word flat. And the word pizza, and everybody already knows pizza is flat. Well, we can trademark flat pizza. This is genius, the more I think about it. But you know what? How is it that people make millions of dollars doing this? Like, how is this possible? I don't understand it. Someone explain to me an actual valid marketing scheme behind this. Like, as Barnum said that no one lost money underestimating the stupidity of the American public. Was that Barnum? I don't agree with that. I agree that we're a good natured people and that we can be reasoned with. To prove him wrong, don't buy a flat pizza. Maybe it tastes delicious. In which case, I don't know. But Jack doesn't think it's because Jack doesn't like their products, so he doesn't think it tastes delicious.
Yeah,
so.
I like their cookies.
Oh, you like their cookies?
That's about it.
Why the cookies?
I don't know. You have the option to get like chips or a cookie with your sandwich, and I've enjoyed those cookies.
Yeah,
they're kind of like gooey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You never had a Subway cookie? No. You ever had a Subway sandwich?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had one literally the other day because my kids are like, we're going to go to Subway, Dad. I'm like, oh, great. Okay. Timothy Helmuth writes in regarding apricots. Hello, Dave, Nastasha et al. I've been enjoying a lot of delicious sun-dried apricots lately, the really sour ones, so presumably the Blenheims, right? Because those are the ones you get that are sour. And got to thinking they'd make a great flavor for a soda. They probably would. Any tips on how to extract the flavor of the apricots, ideally without using alcohol? I hope to share the finished product with some teetotalers. I'd love to hear your thoughts, practical or otherwise. Thanks, Timothy. Okay, listen. So the main question, obviously, is do you have a centrifuge, right? So let's just assume you don't have a centrifuge. You're going to want to go to modernistpantry.com, modernistpantry.com, and get yourself some Pectinex Ultra SPL if you don't already have it. And because what we're going to do is we're going to break down the pectin in the apricot. If you don't, it's going to be like a nightmare. Also, apricots take a long time to rehydrate. I think you remember there was a caller who called in before because they were doing prunes and apricots in a bag, and the apricots wouldn't hydrate and the prunes would. It takes a while. And my experience has been making alcoholic products with apricots in a centrifuge that I literally have to blend it, spin it, and then blend it again and spin it again to get like the full flavor of the apricot out, just because it's so resistant sometimes to rehydration. So what I would do is I would mix the apricots start with like 4-to-1 in water, so like 100-to-400. You might have to go a little more. You might have to go 100 apricots, 500 water. Get warm water, right? Make it warm. Body temp or thereabouts. Add some enzyme. Add like more than I would normally add. Add like 4 grams per liter of Pectinex Ultra SPL and blend the hell out of it. So what you're doing here is that the Pectinex is going to start breaking down the internal, the actual structure of the apricot and allow you to extract more of the flavor. It's also going to break down some of the soluble pectin. You don't want to cook it beforehand because then it makes it more resistant. My feeling is, I haven't proved it, but I think it makes it more resistant to the Pectinex. So you're going to be breaking down the products. Then you're going to want to strain that, right, through like a fine strainer. Coffee filter on it yet, because it's just going to be frustrating. Then re-blend the pulp that's left with Pectinex again and some more water, and let it sit for a while to really break down, and blend it again, let it break down, strain it out, then put that sucker through a coffee filter, and it should you should be able to get a product that's clear enough to make a soda out of. If not, you could probably let it settle overnight. Once you've added the Pectinex and strained it out, you should be able to let it settle overnight and then rack the stuff off the top. But, I mean, I know I've done it with centrifuges and it's delicious, but it's just your yields aren't very high on those apricots unless you do that second re-wetting, which I call remouillage, after the French stock technique of re-wetting the bones. Yeah? Re-wetting the bones. Should we take a break?
Sure.
Take a commercial break. Come right back with Cooking Issues.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hey guys, we on? No.
Yeah.
Hey guys, what's Steve Jenkins? He sounds like some voiceover actor.
That's because he was a voiceover actor.
Come on.
I'm serious.
For real?
For real. He spent some time doing voiceover work. Maybe, I don't know, I'll have to look up his credits. Maybe you heard him somewhere.
Or maybe it's just like that voice is like, you know, the man's got a golden voice.
Golden.
Does he do a cheese show for you guys?
We profiled him on Evolutionaries, which is that really awesome thing we do where we do like radio documentaries on people's lives and tell their stories. He was episode number one, so I recommend that. There's a lot of his voice, and he says some pretty cool stuff, talking about like, you know, he used to import illegal cheeses, and the people didn't know any better at the airports because they couldn't read French, and It was all like raw illegal cheeses.
I remember that time. And yep. In fact, he used to get really, really angry, really angry, whenever someone in the media would point out that New York City, I mean, like virulently angry, when people in the media would point out that cheesemongers in New York were bringing in illegal cheeses, because he didn't want the tap to stop flowing. You know what I mean? So he was nervous about it, and he was like, can't you just shut up and like let me bring in the cheese? You know what I'm saying? That was in the old days. So he doesn't do that anymore? He's too big, been too outed, or what?
I can't speak to that.
Ah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But apparently everything was fake back before him. Like, even when they were selling things they called Canembert or whatever, it wasn't actually that. Some.
Right. Well, you know, look, that – I mean, it's hard for people to remember unless they you know, think back to it. So I first started shopping at Fairway for his cheese stuff in, I don't know, like the early 90s or mid 90s, I guess, when they moved the Fairway, when they first created the Uptown Fairway over in Harlem, where my studio was at the time. And it was like a revelation, because, you know, you've been shopping at places that you thought like had decent cheeses for years, like Zabar's and you know, those kind of joints, and then they really upped the game. You know, it's like people forget. It was kind of a groundbreaking place to buy cheese. I didn't live down near the downtown cheese shop, so my early exposure to that kind of level of cheese stuff was uptown at the Fairway. So yeah, kudos. But he's not like the voice is not quite. It's not Casey Kasem. It's like it's a mix. Like, where is it? It's like in the voiceover world. I gotta figure out where it is. Anyway, and you're gonna look up his credits.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find. I can dig it. We'll see.
Yeah. All right. Paul writes in regarding benzoate. So we're on preservatives and other stuff today, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sodium benzoate. It's a good word, isn't it? I would like to hear Alec Baldwin say benzoate. I bet he'd be awesome at it. Hi, all. I've just been listening to episode 149. Yes, I'm a few weeks behind. You were answering a question about stabilizing fruit juices, and I think I understood that Piper uses benzoate to prevent microbial growth. I don't recommend doing this because a few years ago, it was shown that benzoate can convert to benzene over time. Benzene, nasty, by the way, in case you guys don't remember your chemistry. Can convert to benzene over time, especially in acidic environments and especially in the presence of vitamin C. I think Piper was aware of that. I don't know how much benzoate he used in his – whatever. I know this because I was working at the time at a company that produces food supplements, including a berry extract. And due to regulatory changes, we had to change the preservative that we were using. I was researching alternatives and came across this issue. If my memory serves me correctly – I'm sure it does – the major soft drink manufacturers removed benzoate from their products when this problem was identified. I did some accelerated tests, incubating at warm temperatures, and found that benzene did in fact form when we added benzoate to the product, the berry product they were making. In the end, we chose sorbate, which also avoided the problem that a small proportion of people can taste benzoate. I recommend that benzoate not be used in fruit juice applications, or if it is used, that you send samples away for testing so you can determine if benzene does form over the duration that you keep your products. Keep up the great work, Paul. Thanks. I love that kind of follow-up. So that's good information. So people can take, you know, that's good stuff. We got a – Sam writes in, hey, Stas. He says, hey, Nastasha, because that's what you should say. Thanks for answering my questions on the radio show. I now have a request. Dave is an undoubted ninja of kitchen ergonomics. I don't know about that. And layout. Could you see if he will post an in-depth photo tour of his home kitchen? Thanks, Sam. It's not quite done yet, Sam. When I actually get my when I get my oven customized. You like my new kitchen better.
Yeah. Really clean.
Yeah, but it's like it's galley.
Yeah.
But all my equipment's new. That's why you like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Won't be new for long. I'm sure I'll ruin it. All right. So Sam, once I get it done, I'll do that. I'm still changing it. It's not quite photo ready yet. Brian writes in from San Diego about koji, which has been the topic that I've been remiss in getting the information on. We've had a lot about. He says, hey, Cooking Issues crew, longtime listener. I don't have a question, but was listening to your show and also wondering about how to make aspergillus. I can never pronounce it. Or Rizzi, you know, the rice-based one, the one that they use for koji. Aspergillus spores to make koji. In case the In case the Momofuku people don't get back to you, Dave, I found a couple of resources on the web, which you may or may not already know about. It seems publicly available information on this topic is scarce. One is TaylorMade, AK.org, growing koji for homebrewing sake. And the other one is, of course, well-known, the NordicFoodLab.org, their blog and their thing, Koji History and Process. And the Nordic Food Lab, for all of you who don't know, is a great resource. Like, you know, they do a great job. They document everything they do, and they're very open source about information, and they don't hide information. And they do a lot of work with koji, and they publish it. So I actually went to the tab you sent me, and it's good. And, of course, Shirtleaf, who, you know, as anyone who's heard me say knows that I learned, you know, most of what I know about tofu from Shirtleaf, even though he, you know, basically called me a jerk for asking whether I could use edamame to make tofu. He was like, why would you do that? You're evil. He thinks I'm an evil. Well, in the one phone conversation he had with me, he intimated that he wouldn't want to have dinner with me and that he thought I was a bad human being.
Wow.
I mean, he didn't come out and say it like that, but that's just the vibe I got over the phone. You know what I mean? He's like, why is this Eastern son of a whatever? He doesn't talk that way. He's like all peace and love and whatever. But anyway, his website, www.soyinfocenter.com, books/154, History of Koji, is there. But I looked up an interesting article because the issue is this. Look, everyone knows you can make koji. You can buy the koji can, the seeds for it, and do it. The question we had a while back was, how do you know if it's safe? And the problem is that some strains of Aspergillus, right, like Flavus and whatnot, can produce aflatoxin. And aflatoxin, you know, for those of you that, you know, pay attention to this sort of thing, you want to stay away from, because even minute quantities, it's one of those no known safe kind of exposure things, because minute quantities can be like viciously carcinogenic. And so this is why we screen things like peanuts, which can grow aflatoxin for, you know, for the growth of it and whatnot. So the question is, why don't people get poisoned all the time from things that are done made with koji, because they're all done with different Aspergillus strains? And how is it that you can select for the safe ones in a either home, wild, or industrial setting? How do you choose to and make sure that you only get the ones that don't produce aflatoxin? So there's a lot of people have done studies and shown that that aflatoxin is not present in products commercially that are produced with koji molds, right? So, soys and misos and things like that. And a couple of ones have shown that miso itself is not hospitable for the production of aflatoxin, but it's aged for a long time. So the question you want to know is, how can I guarantee that the mold that I'm growing right now on my koji is safe to use right now? Not necessarily in an aged product, not necessarily in a secondary product, but how do I guarantee that it's safe in all points of its existence? And it's an interesting problem. And as of 2001, which is the last article that I have on it, they hadn't really 100% solved it. But the most interesting article I saw on it was called Aflatoxin Genes and the Aflatoxinogenic Potential. That's a good word, right? Mm-hmm. I can try that twice. Aflatoxinogenic, well, whatever, of koji molds by oh my god, I can't read my writing on what the person's name was. It was the last name. Vanderbroek. Vanderbroek. P. Vanderbroek. 2001. And it was interesting. So what they said was, look, they analyzed a bunch of strains of Aspergillus that they found in various products that have been produced, some kind of artisanal wild fermentation types and some commercial types. They found in that they found some strains of normal Aspergillus oaks. I can't pronounce that. I don't know why. It's got a mental block on it. I can't do it. That actually had the genes encoded in them to produce aflatoxin, but did not in fact produce aflatoxin, which is difficult if you want to make a rapid assay to make sure that there's no aflatoxin in it, right? They also found certain Aspergillus flavus molds in there that were aflatoxin-producing strains, but they didn't find any aflatoxin. Now, the Nordic Food Lab has a couple of points on this where they say, look at, aflatoxin, when it's produced, those strains that produce that tend to inhibit yeast growth. And so people that are doing things like brewing sake, where you have a lot of alcohol involved, over time, the only Aspergillus strains that don't produce aflatoxin are selected out. And so that's how the safety goes. But we're not talking about that because we're not talking about maintaining a culture for, you know, generations. We're talking about a wild thing and how to prove it's safe. So here's what's interesting. These guys said, look, we made a bunch of koji and it didn't produce aflatoxin, right? So they said, okay, I'm going to take a strain of Aspergillus that's known to produce aflatoxin, like one that we bought specifically to produce aflatoxin. And they, because their thing was, well, maybe this, because like koji fermentation is solid state fermentation under very particular circumstances for fairly short periods of time. So they said, okay, look it. We're gonna put this known aflatoxin generator into typical koji production, and lo and behold, it produced like zero, almost like hyper trace amounts of aflatoxin. So they're like, hey, that's pretty safe. So they're like, well, maybe it's something about the actual substrate that we're growing it on that's stopping it produce. So instead of running it for 24 hours, they ran it for like a week or something like this. And after a week of incubation or a week and a half, then there were measurable and meaningful amounts of aflatoxin present. So their conclusion, which I think interesting, is that these strains that can produce aflatoxin take longer to start producing the aflatoxin in the solid state fermentation that we do in koji, take longer to produce the aflatoxin than typically they would have to produce it when you're making the koji. So if you're going to use a wild fermentation of koji, then I wouldn't let that aspect of the fermentation go on longer than, you know, like, you know, the day or so it takes to do it. And I would read that article because it made for interesting reading. But that's the closest I could get for an answer on how can you guarantee, without having, a microbiology lab present, how can you guarantee the safety of any given wild koji that you're making? Do you think that's a good final answer on that?
I think that's great.
You don't care. Whatever. You know what?
You need that feedback.
You know what you guys don't get? You don't get the look on Stas's face. It's like someday I'll be able to describe it. She's like, yeah, great.
I know you need the feedback.
Yeah, all right. Kyle Kleberg. I like that name, Kleberg. Kleberg, because I like Stan Freberg. Have you ever heard of Stan Freberg?
No.
Old comedian?
No.
From the 50s?
No.
He was an advertising guy, like kind of, I guess, pre-Mad Men? Yeah, pre-Mad Men era advertising guy who he did a bunch of radio shows. Anyway, for those of you who are history of advertising buffs and like 50s comedians, Stan Freberg's the man. Anyway, Kyle Kleberg says, hey there, I've got a question for the cooking issues. Our restaurant recently acquired 100 pounds of high-quality spot prawns, and it just so spot prawns. You like spot prawns? You ever have that?
No.
It's West Coast, but it's Northern. You never hang out up there, right?
Mm-mm.
Like BC and all that stuff? They're supposedly good. Like, we don't get them here. You know, like at least I don't get them here, of high-quality spot prawns. And as it just so happens, about two-thirds of them were carrying eggs. While discussing a plan, my chef, in his infinite wisdom, took a ninth pan full of roe and tossed it into the Vita Prep with a healthy dose of neutral oil to make shrimp oil. As you can imagine, we ended up with about 6 cups of shrimp aioli. Yes, because it has eggs. They will emulsify the hell out of stuff. Anyways. So I came to you guys with questions, hoping you can help me write this. First, would the eggs of prawns be called roe or coral? And secondly, is there a way to purposely break this emulsion? Break this emulsion. And now I have a song going to take these broken wings and learn to fly again. Do you have that? Learn to live so free?
Yeah, but who is that?
That's the song.
King Blackbird?
No. Is that? Learn to fly and learn to live so free. Really?
I think so.
No, that's different. It's different. Jack will know. Jack or Joe will know. Anyway. And second, is there a way to purposely break this emulsion and turn it back to an oil of some sort while maintaining the flavor of the raw eggs? If this is a lost cause, I still think I still have some reserve to make a compound butter, which I hope will be a better plan. However, if I've learned a thing from listening to Cooking Issues, it's that things are not always as simple as they seem. Thanks, Kyle Kleberg, the Palouse in – what's ID, I wonder? Washington, I understand.
Maybe Idaho?
Really? Like on the border? Yeah. Really? I don't know. Okay, so listen. First of all, when you say carrying eggs, I'm presuming you meaning on the outside, on their swimmerettes. So here's the deal. So decapod crustaceans, the way that they do their business. First of all, interesting spot prawns. If you want a little thing about spot prawns, and I got some of this information from it, www.organicocean.com. Spot prawn, and I can't remember because it's been a long, long time since I've done my. I went through a kick where I read a lot of lobster biology stuff because I was thinking about writing an article for the New York Times, and they wanted me to prove that. Whether or not lobsters could feel pain. I was like, I can't do that. That's not possible. Anyway, so I can't remember whether lobsters do this, but spot prawns are cool because they're big and delicious, apparently. But they change sex. Then they become females. Then they do their eggs. When they're changing their sex, they're called trannies. How awesome is that? That's what it says according to the website. Anyway, so anyway, in decapod crustaceans, when the females are going to lay the eggs, typically when you have a lobster and you have what's called the coral. Do you like that, the red stuff when it's cooked out?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you have the coral as opposed to the tamale, which is like kind of the guts. Do you like the tamale?
Mm-mm.
But you like the coral.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good to know. So I don't really okay. I'll lay it out on you. I'm not a huge fan of the tamale. Like I can eat a little bit of it, but I don't want to pound that stuff. You know what I mean? You know? No. Anyways, so the coral is the eggs on the inside of the lobster, right? No one, at least not on this coast, eats the – and when you said that the shrimps are carrying eggs, I think you mean on the outside of the shrimp, right? So what happens is the lobster, or in this case the shrimp, passes the egg from the inside of its body to the outside. And as it gets passed to the outside, that's when it gets fertilized, and then it glues it to the underside of its body. So when you get a female lobster out of the water, you look at the bottom of – yeah, no, lobsters stay females. They stay freaking females. They don't do this weird tranny stuff. Anyways – what am I thinking? So, like, you turn it over, and they're called buried, right? They're not, like, buried, like, in the ground, like, not like Gravad lobster, but, like, buried, like, Knott's Berry Farm. And because they put the eggs all on the underside of their body. Now, lobster folk, when they get buried lobsters, are supposed to throw them back, like, notch the tail and throw them back because they know that's a producing female. Right? And you want to leave the producing females in the water so that they make more lobsters because that's your bread and butter, right? You know? So you never get buried. You get females, but you never get ones that are buried because they throw them back. So I would not call it coral because, as far as I know, coral is only when it's on the inside of the animal. And since these have made it to the outside and are fertilized, right, presumably they – I don't know whether the fertilization makes them change flavor or texture or what. I have no idea because, I don't have any experience with it. But interesting, these guys at Organic Ocean said – some spot prawns are brought in from the United States where they are caught sooner, smaller, and often buried, i.e. before spawning and with eggs attached. One Asian grocer is selling live British Columbia spot prawns, which would have to have been from the United States. The BC season opens later when the prawns have grown to full size and are about to die naturally. So buyer beware. So Organic Ocean believes that they lay eggs and then they croak, right? Because it says they say that wild BC spot prawns are hermaphroditic, born as males. The female sex organs on their tails become more pronounced at about 2 years of age, at which point they are referred to as transitioning prawns or trannies. With the final 2 years of their 4-year lifespan sent as females, so they do their spawning and then they're ready to die. So you should take it afterwards. So that's just on whether to call it coral or whether to call it roe. I would call it roe or eggs. Now, on the breaking of it, you have very few people who want to break this kind of egg emulsion, and I wasn't able to find anything offhand that would break it. The only easy thing that I thought you could do two things. One, you can add so much oil to it that it breaks, right? Because that's one way to break a mayonnaise is to stop adding water and to just add enough oil, like, you know, 95%, so that you actually start breaking the emulsion and you get oil coalescence. That should work, but the problem with that is you will be adding so much oil to it that you probably won't have the flavor transfer. The other thing, and you might have already tried this is you might, because you said, I don't know whether I read it, but you know, you intimated that you didn't want to heat it because you didn't want to change the flavor, right? Didn't he say that? Mm-hmm. Did he say that? Yeah. I would freeze it. I would freeze it and then thaw it and then freeze it and then thaw it and then freeze it and you thaw it. And each time you freeze thaw it, you should be destabilizing that emulsion. And hopefully after one or two freeze thaw cycles, because you haven't added any stabilizers other than the stabilizers naturally present in the prawn eggs, hopefully it'll break. And then you'll be able to get, you know, and if you have a centrifuge, obviously I would freeze thaw and then try the centrifuge. But that should work. And you know, I would stop it from – I would not let it get exposed to oxygen while you're doing all that freeze-thawing. But, you know, so like put it in a vac bag or in a zippy and then freeze-thaw it a couple times, see whether it works. But if you try it, please send me the answer because I want to know whether it worked, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, Kurt writes in. Hello, everybody. I've just recently become head bartender of a restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right next to the MIT campus. The building complex that we are in hosts the Cambridge Science Festival every year. I bet you that's a pretty good science festival.
Yeah.
And has asked if we would like to be a part of it. I've been using a handful of modern techniques behind the bar, Pectinex/agar clarification, carbonation, EC infusions, and the like. I added the like. It wasn't in there. So the chef decided I'd be the best candidate for the job. I made an off-the-cuff comment about how cool it would be to have a rotovap and centrifuge to play around with for this presentation, and a day later I got an email asking exactly what I needed for equipment. These guys have a lot of lab connections. I've attached the email I've received with some questions about equipment. Also, I'll be giving a presentation to 75 to 100 people, which I've not done before, and was wondering if you might have any general advice on giving demos to an audience like that. I clearly plan on ignoring that gem of advice that Thomas Keller gave you last week, where he called me an idiot. Thanks, Kurt. Okay. The attached questions are regarding the centrifuge and rotovap. I have a few ideas on who to ask, but a few questions for you. What size centrifuge? Do you need tubes? What size rotovap? I assume you need a vacuum for the rotovap. And what about the cleanliness of a rotovap? Typically, the flasks are used are clean in a glass cleaner and autoclave, but is this okay for food, especially if they've previously been used with dangerous chemicals, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so look it. So a lot depends. Let's start with the centrifuge. Let's start with the presentation, right? When you're going to do a technique, when you're going to do a demo for a lot of people with modern techniques, people like to see rotovaps run, right, Stas? We've done that a bunch of times.
Very true.
Yeah, they like to see it run. Here's the issue. If you aren't really good at running a rotovap, it's going to take you a while to set the sucker up, and it's going to take you – when you're first setting up a rotovap, assuming you haven't played with one before, and you put food products in, it's going to boil over. I'm just telling you that right now. It's going to boil over, and that's a nightmare. And let me tell you from experience, you don't want to boil over in front of a big audience because it makes you feel really stupid, right? Right. The other thing that happens is when you're talking during a demo, here's what people don't like. They don't like to sit and have you sit there and stare at the machine for like half an hour while it's distilling, right? So you're going to have to bring someone with you that after you wave your hands over it and do the magical touches on it and everything like that and get the sucker running – right, and during that time when you get the sucker running, you can't be talking or doing anything because you're going to have to make sure the sucker doesn't boil over on you, unless you don't want to do a good job. Right, there's always that. Right, but you don't want to sit there staring at it. So someone's got to run it. The other problem with a rotovap is that rotovaps take a long time to produce appreciable amounts of product. So what I would do is choose a product in a rotovap that you can make that you can give relatively small tastes of, like really small, like less like quarter ounce, like little skim shot coats, like really strong flavored stuff that you can give small amounts of. I would stay and you're going to want to make them beforehand. So even though things like fresh herbs are the best things to do in rotovap, or one of the best things to do in a rotovap, you don't want to do that because then you can't make that sucker the night before. Which brings me to my next point. Never demonstrate a rotovap that you haven't fired up before and run for at least a couple of hours. You're going to need this rotovap well in advance so that you can A, make the product that you're going to hand out at the event, and B, get the hang of using it, right? You're also going to need a vacuum pump, obviously. You're going to want as good a vacuum pump as you want. The chem folks don't need a particularly good vacuum pump because they're not worried about getting good recovery of flavor, right? Ideally, what you would like to have is a bunch of liquid nitrogen and a cold finger, right? Because otherwise, you're going to need a chiller. Because chem folks, they're like, well, just chill it with tap water. Just chill it with tap water. No, that's crap. That's crap flavor. That's not right. You can't just chill your condenser with tap water and expect to get a decent flavor out of it. Because then, first of all, you're going to need to run your bath at 60 degrees Celsius, right, 140. So, like, why bother? Then you're dealing with 60. Then you're dealing with 40 and change as the temperature of your of the actual product in there that's being distilled, and you're dealing with 20 degrees, give or take, is the temperature of the tap water that you're running off of circulating through your condenser, and you have a very small temperature difference between your product and your chiller. I like to have like very large temperature differences, right? And I like to keep my stuff as cold as possible. So like when I'm running a condenser, a regular condenser, I run it, I'm doing alcohol, which is illegal, but hey, at like minus 20 degrees Celsius, and you need a chiller for that. And then when you bring a chiller into the factory, you can run a rotovap with a water bath and a vacuum pump off of a single socket. You can't reliably run a rotovap with a chiller off of one socket. I've seen them blow in demos all the time. Here's another thing people are going to – so if you can't get the liquid nitrogen, get it. If not, get a chiller or find something that you can do hotter and it's not going to hurt it, like chocolate, you know, like cocoa nibs or something like that. But they boil over. Another thing, get the biggest freaking distillation flask that you can get, right? Now, everyone's always going to be like, here's a liter flask. And they're going to give you one with a tiny little freaking what's the thing I'm looking – so I'm holding up tiny – what's this word, Stas? Neck. Tiny neck. And the problem is it's hard to load stuff in and out of it, and they tend to boil over more violently with the thing when they boil over. So you want a flask as possible. Never fill it more than a quarter full, especially when you're learning. Otherwise, you're going to have boil over problems, right? Get the biggest around – it's called vapor duct, which is how the actual vapor gets transferred into the condenser area. The biggest one you can. Chem folks always mess up. They always give you the small thing. Why? Because they're very rarely doing rotary evaporation in quantity. They're doing it for more like for analysis, and so it's not – they don't deal usually in like kind of those large style quantities that we're dealing with. So those are some of the recommendations. They also – like there's inherent problems with most rotovaps in that the stuff that's being distilled down isn't getting chilled properly, so you're going to want to chill the receiver so that you don't redistill off of it too many times. On centrifuges, you know, if they're going to let you use one, get new buckets. I mean, I almost exclusively use 3-liter benchtop centrifuges, swinging bucket centrifuges, and they're great for cocktails, great, along with Pectinex. But, you know, if they have a 500-mil fixed liter rotor that, you know, has, the tubes in it and a handle, you know, you just do a couple more spins in those. They usually do higher Gs anyway. And some of those things, you know, I wouldn't use it for everyday restaurant service, but for a demo, you can get a couple extra spins out of it. I once in Colombia did a demo for more than 100 people using that tiny $200 centrifuge we got on Amazon. I just had to sit there for 4 hours spinning, you know, tiny tube after tiny tube. So you can get any of that that you need. So the size on the rotovap, the size itself of the rotovap is not so important. You want a 3-liter flask and probably like a 1-liter receiver. If you can get an LN a cold finger condenser for it, do that. On the cleaning, I'd be a little careful. I don't know what kind of chemical. Presumably, the people who have it know what kind of chemicals have been put into it. If you can get new glassware, get new glassware. There can be some persistent nasties that get into stuff, especially. Well, anyway, but I mean, they try to make them nice because they're glass and they're, you know, non-absorptive things like Teflon and whatnot. But you know, be cautious. The other thing is try to get. Certain brands of rotary evaporator are horrible. You know, I use Buki. Heidolf is good. You want to get glassware that's coated in plastic. It's called Plasglass. And when you look at it, you can see that it's got a coating on it because it's a little bit wavy. If it doesn't have that, you need to wear safety goggles at all times because if it's really clear-looking glass, it means it hasn't been coated. Those could implode at any minute and send shards of glass flying around into your eyes, which doesn't make for a good demo. Turns out it makes for a bad demo. But whenever you're doing technology, be sure to have your products done beforehand, because I've had anything and everything go wrong on stage, right? And so luckily, because everybody knows that I'm kind of discombobulated and disorganized anyway, I can just kind of smile and shake my head and it all seems to go away, at least most of the time. Right, Stas?
True.
But that only works if you have the product beforehand to make sure that no one's leaving empty-handed. I'm also, whenever anyone's demonstrating new techniques, and for any of you out there, hopefully you all do, you know, use some of these new techniques, when you go demonstrate them, I really believe that you should hand out tastes of things whenever possible from what you're doing. And the reason is it's really easy to get a piece of fancy equipment and put it up on stage and have people be like, wow, that's cool, that's awesome. But what the real challenge is showing people that they're not just like weird science tricks or gimmicks, that they actually can produce delicious products. And so I've always been a fan of handing people things to taste at the demos to prove that what you're showing them on stage isn't just some BS that you're doing for a gimmick. And that's that. Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.